You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, our guest says leaks of government information get a bad rap, and they're an important part of keeping the public informed.
First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. This week, a jury awarded $6.7 million to a former female inmate at the Milwaukee County Jail. The woman said she was raped at least five times by a correctional officer there.
Robert Menser joins us now, as he does every Friday. He's a storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back.
Hello.
Well, tell us the story of this court settlement in this Milwaukee County Jail inmate.
Yes, yeah, so there are two key findings here. The first was the jury's decision to award $6.7 million to a woman who was raped by a jail guard when she was an inmate in the Milwaukee County Jail. The second is the finding that the jail was wrong to keep her shackled to her hospital bed while she was in labor and giving birth to her daughter in 2013, and the finding that there was, quote, no legitimate government purpose to do that.
So who, on the damage side of this, who is paying the damages awarded to the plaintiff?
So Milwaukee County is on the hook. So what happens? So the woman here is not named in news reports because she's a victim of a crime. She first came forward a couple years ago, gave a long interview to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about her experience, and also brought this to the fore, right? So. And a guard named Xavier Thicklin was charged with multiple counts of sexual assault in the case. He later pled guilty to a lesser charge, and he was fired from his job. And then there was this was a civil lawsuit that came in the wake of that criminal case.
Now, this comes amidst a lot of news coming out of the Milwaukee County Jail. Can you put this story into the larger context there?
Right. Now, exactly. Now, so this story is significant on its own, for sure, but it also fits into this larger story about Milwaukee County Sheriff David Clark, the alleged mismanagement of the jail. It follows very closely on the conclusion of an inquest last month that recommended criminal charges against seven jail staff members in the death by dehydration of an inmate who was left in his cell without water for 7 days. And that death is one of four deaths in the jail in recent years. So this case, which does not involve a death, did involve criminal actions as well as bad, inhumane policy decisions by the jail. And so it is seen as, and that's sort of what makes it especially interesting, is that it is part of this larger discussion about how that institution is run and the leadership of Sheriff Clark.
Now, these stories have been coming out one at a time. This one because of the civil suit and the ruling there. Others because of the deaths being investigated individually. Has there been any talk that you know of a wider overall investigation?
Well, there is the thing that Sheriff Clark would like nothing more than for this to be fit into sort of a partisan lens, right? In general, his reaction has been that I have these political enemies. They don't like me because I'm, Team Trump, or I'm a conservative and outspoken about it. And these people are after me. But at some point, like, there is an accretion of these incidents, and it feels like the counter argument to that is that there is a pattern here. This is not at some point you can't call these isolated incidents.
Talking to Robert Menser, storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, looking at some of the top stories in Wisconsin news over the last week. Let's go back to last weekend. Rob, Democrats had their annual state convention. This comes after another election cycle that is a low point in a series of low points for Democrats in the state. What was the general tone of the convention?
Well, it seems like the general tone of the convention was fairly upbeat, right? The Democrats reelected Martha Lanning to be the party chairwoman. pretty handily, actually. On the face of it, you know, as you say, the things really couldn't have gone worse for the Democratic Party in 2016. But whatever happened in November is may feel like ancient history, or the something has changed. It is definitely the case that in the Trump era, the sort of activist energy is with the Democrats, and so the way that the tone of that gathering was more about building on that energy and sort of getting psyched up for 2018 elections that are coming, much more so than sort of backbiting or attempts at unseating leadership who. Demonstrably, I mean, like, whether, you know, there's a lot of factors that go into that, but, like, I don't think any Democrat would say that that 2016 went the way that they hoped it would.
You mentioned that 2018 election coming up, two big high-profile statewide races, U.S. Senate, Tammy Baldwin, incumbent there, so she'll be running against a Republican challenger. Governor Scott Walker, I don't know if he's actually said the official words, "I am running."
Oh, he said it. Who is he kidding?
Right.
He's all but said it.
He has said he would wait till after the state budget is done to make that formal announcement anyway. But so that leaves the Democrats trying to figure out who's going to run against him. What do we know about the Democratic field for governor next year?
Sure. Well, it's early yet. So, you know, you never know, right? Someone can come on strong closer to the actual vote. But so, you know, we know some things just as of this week. We know that Democrats at the convention favored Senator Kathleen Vinehout for governor. She won the sort of straw poll that they have. She was in the primary last time around, but she dropped out after she had a bad car accident. She's kind of an interesting figure. She's a dairy farmer from Alma. So her district is in rural western Wisconsin, well outside of the Madison and Milwaukee sort of Democratic strongholds. And she's also a health policy wonk with a PhD. And then the other thing that happened this week was the Madison mayor, Paul Soglin, floated a run for governor himself. Soglin's been around for a very long time. He has a long career in Madison. And he's known to be sort of a blunt guy. And his case for running for governor is that he can tap into the Bernie Sanders wing of the Democratic Party, run kind of an "I'm from Madison and I'm proud of it" campaign. And who knows, maybe that style of politics seems to be on the rise. So you never know.
And finally, news broke this week that the Marinette County District Attorney resigned in protest over state funding levels and a lack of employees there. Can you tell us about that story?
Right. This is really interesting. Yeah, Marinette County's District Attorney Alan Bry quit his job. His last day was Friday, he told the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel that, quote, "morally, I can't continue working in a system that treats victims this way." So he cited the backlog of cases, the lack of staff support for the job. And it is true. It's been a very long time since the state has increased the budget for prosecutors. It's been since Governor Tommy Thompson, to give you a sense. So this is like a longstanding issue. And there are independent studies that say Wisconsin falls well short of recommended standards. So his resigning, he said he hoped to shine a light on that. And it was a sort of thing that was getting responses from prosecutors all over the state saying that the problems that he's pointing out are real.
Is there any thought that this light on the issue is going to make any difference as lawmakers go through the state budget?
Well, you know, it's hard. It's a bit hard to predict. The easy answer would be probably not, and maybe not. But you know, it's a bit weird that prosecutors are law enforcement. The state budgets have habitually increased funding for the Department of Justice or for police. And so it doesn't seem like it should be an impossible thing to ask. And, you know, the truth is that DAs have a lot of discretion. They have a lot of power in our justice system. And, it's at the same time, it's not you know, no one could say that it's the ideal case to have these sort of thousands of cases of backlogs and them having to sort of constantly be in triage mode. So it feels like it's a real issue and one that that probably deserves a debate.
We'll leave it there for now. Rob, thanks for joining us.
All right. Thank you.
That's Robert Mentzer, storytelling editor for the USA Today Network, Wisconsin. He's based in Wausau. He joins us every Friday for a look at some of the week's biggest news. Leaks have been in the news lately. In many cases, leaks have been the news. From disclosures about the president revealing intelligence sources to Russia to an intelligence contractor arrested this week for releasing info about Russian cyber attacks on election software companies and local voting offices.
And the issue came up in yesterday's Senate Intelligence Committee testimony. Former FBI Director James Comey said he asked a friend to share the contents of his presidential conversation memos with the press. President Trump said today at a press conference, Comey's a leaker.
Speaking of Twitter, our next guest tweeted a series of thoughts about the value of leaks in political reporting. Paul Singer is with us now. He's a Washington correspondent for USA Today. Paul, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, you had a little mini Twitter storm recently about leaks. What led you to want to put that out there?
Oh, I don't know. I must have had a beer or something. There had been a whole series of conversations, you know, leaks are bad, and people have to stop the leaks and stop the leaks. And, you know, leaks are fundamental to democracy. It is how information the government doesn't want to get out gets out. It is the definition of what you want. And my whole point of this little tweet storm was, listen, if you believe in democracy and you believe in a free press, you believe in challenging the official version of events, no matter who the president is, you want leaks.
And what do we, the public, we get out of having leaks and having the press have access to them?
Well, let me give you an example. I think this is relevant to you guys particularly because I know there's been a conversation about the VA hospitals in Wisconsin, for example. You know, my colleague Don Slack has done great work on the VA, and at one point someone leaked her an internal ranking system whereby the VA was basically grading its medical facilities on which ones were good and which ones were not very good. And this is information that would have been very useful for the public to have, but the VA was not making it public because they didn't want to. Well, Donovan published the information, and lo and behold, first the VA complained, and then they ranted and raved, and then they set up a website and began routinely releasing this information to the public. So now you can actually look and see whether the VA near you is rated good, rated not good, rated making progress, or whatever. I think that's an important, valuable service that was provided by somebody within the VA or with access to VA materials who said, you know what, we are doing something here that should be public. But the government, that is, the administration who was in the VA at the time, did not want this to be public, and they were wrong.
We're talking to Paul Singer from USA Today. He's looking at leaks and why he says leaks are a good thing, a thing that we should be glad are out there. A lot of leaks in the news lately in the midst of the Trump administration, leaks about in some cases, classified information. The question is, when is the right time to leak? When is the wrong time to leak? What is the responsibility of the press in handling leaks? Paul, let's get into some recent examples from the U.S. government here. You cited a few historical examples before the Trump administration from both parties, Nixon, Clinton, Obama. Can you talk about a couple of those examples?
Well, sure. The Obama one that was at the front of my mind at the time was this notion, this whole issue of the very end of the Obama administration, we got back a handful of people who were held as prisoners, Americans who were being held as prisoners by the Iranians. It just so happened that through a leak, I believe, we discovered that the U.S. government had delivered $400 billion in cash to Iran at the same time. And the administration said, well, of course, there's no connection between those two things. But in fact, it was. And they had to admit, ultimately, that they basically held this payment to Iran. They, for long story about why they owed this money to Iran, it was an old sanctions case. they held the money until they were sure that the hostages were being released. So, to some degree, paid for hostages. But that story never would have come out if it hadn't been for the leak. Go back before that, you know, whether it was, you know, Watergate was full of leaks. It was a whole series of people telling reporters that the president had a secret government basically operating within the White House. You know, Clinton administration, it was ultimately a leak that surfaced the fact that the president was having a sexual relationship with an intern she had lied about. Again, this is where I understand there may be opinions that we are harming national security, and we tend to be very careful about that stuff. But the government's official story is not the whole story, and leaks are frequently how we get the other side of the story.
And you mentioned the issue of national security. What's the responsibility of a journalist, of a journalistic outlet, when looking at information that's maybe classified, that's a national security issue? How do you weigh that?
Yeah, that's a tough one, and it always requires a serious consideration. I mean, I'll tell you that, you know, reporters who travel with the military, whenever they embed, for instance, a reporter with a military expedition, we are required to not release that information about where they are. We're not allowed to report on movements and timing of travel, and we live by those guidelines because we don't want any soldiers to be in danger because we tweeted or wrote a story saying, hey, we're going to be in Mosul Tuesday with this batch of soldiers. So journalists have a way to be very responsible about that kind of stuff. And by the way, we also get phone calls from the government when we call to ask, say, hey, I've got these documents, I'm going to publish them. We frequently get phone calls from government agencies saying, well, you can't publish those because there is some national security concern. And at that point, personally, as a reporter, my view is we hand it over to the lawyers. We have lawyers who are determined to ask, when can we publish? It's their job to figure out whether there actually is national security interest at risk here or not. That is not the reporter's job anymore. That's the lawyer's job. We give it over to the lawyers and let them hash it out. The reporter's job is to always want the story out.
Now, there are a lot of other outlets releasing news now online. There are the Drudge Report, BuzzFeed, The Intercept, things like that. Do they have the same practices? Do they have the same responsibility?
I would say they have the same responsibility. Whether they believe that or not is a different question. It is true, Rob. One of the problems now is that because anybody with a laptop and a WordPress account is now a publisher. And so there are people who might get their hands on stuff and publish it without giving any thought to any of these considerations. And that is a problem, because then we all get lumped into the same, you know, the bad lying media, whether you are USA Today or Wisconsin Public Radio or the, you know, Joe's blog. No one can tell the difference. Who was the first one to put out this memo that may or may not have actually been real? You know, did you really fact check it? It's a real problem. I believe, because I've been a reporter for a long, long time, I've taught journalism ethics at Georgetown, I believe that everybody in this profession has to take this extraordinarily seriously. We have to check our facts. We have to check the leak we're getting. We have to ask the source of the leak, what's in this for you? When it's a true fact that we are confident in, we should go ahead and publish it.
I wanted to ask you, Paul, about a couple stories out there this week. One, the arrest of Reality Winner. She was a contractor with a security-related company, released this apparently national security information about Russian attempts to hack, to fish an election software company and then election offices, released that info apparently to The Intercept and was quickly arrested.
Yeah, best name in the business, Reality.
Reality Winner, yeah.
This was dumb everywhere. This was, first of all, it was dumb they gave this person security clearance. She had been on social media basically saying she wanted to burn down the White House. She had done a bunch of things that would raise red flags everywhere. They gave her security clearance anyway. She went to work for this NSA office in Georgia someplace. She got this document about Russian hacking. She turned around and carelessly printed it, carelessly delivered it to a reporter who apparently took a picture of it and sent it to the NSA and said, hey, is this real? We're going to report on it. But, of course, the picture was enough for the NSA to determine that they knew where it came from. You know, it's just like comedy of errors. Everybody looks stupid. Honestly, I don't know whether the information was worth stealing. I don't know how important that story was. The way I just haven't gotten that deep into the question of whether it showed a more in-depth hacking campaign than we knew. But it was an amateur hour on both the leaker's part and the journalists who were handling the leak.
And then as we wrap up, James Comey said, yeah, I asked a friend of mine to share information about my presidential conversation memos. This is after he was out of his job. He said he was careful not to release classified information. Donald Trump's conclusion, Comey's a leaker. What do you make of that story?
Nobody ever admits to being the source of the leak. It was breathtaking. And basically the reason he did it is because he says he believed Trump was going to lie about their meetings. Whole thing is a phenomenally amazing story. And Trump's team is already going to try and file a complaint against James Comey for leaking. So it is not the last we've heard of this one.
We'll leave it there, Paul. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob. Be well. Have a good weekend.
You too. That was Paul Singer. He's a Washington correspondent for USA Today. We've been talking about the role of leaks in political and national security coverage.
Yesterday, House Republicans voted to pass the CHOICE Act, which would effectively repeal major portions of the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act.
The Dodd-Frank Act was passed in 2010 following the Great Recession as a way to avoid another financial calamity. But the act has been criticized by Republican lawmakers as being too stringent, and President Trump has been largely supportive of its repeal.
Karen Coons joins us now. She's an associate professor of public administration at West Virginia University. She's also the co-author of When the Levees Break, Reimagining Regulations in the Securities Market. Karen, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Well, Karen, first let's listen to a clip of House Speaker Paul Ryan talking about the CHOICE Act yesterday.
This also repeals the too big to fail, which makes taxpayer bailouts of Wall Street a thing of the past. Simply put, this is a jobs bill for Main Street. The Financial CHOICE Act makes it possible for small businesses across this country to stop struggling and to start hiring. I want to commend Chairman Hensley and his committee, Mia Love, and everybody on their committee. They have put years of work into this. This is a very important piece of legislation we're very excited about bringing through Congress today, because this is a key piece of our agenda to get the regulatory reform agenda put through, to get jobs growing, and to get the economic growth that we really need and deserve in this country.
Karen, you heard his characterization there, rolling back some regulations, getting at the idea that this is a CHOICE Act for Main Street, for small community banks. Do most economists and small bankers agree that some of these Dodd-Frank regulations were too strict, went too far?
I could see how they could have that perception. One of the things that we argue with, we talk about in our book, is how Congress is, through the years, ever since the big crash in 29, Congress has consistently been reactionary to anything that happens in the markets. And so even as Speaker Ryan talks about worrying about too big to fail, we argue that we're past that already. The next crash is going to be too big to save. We're going to be beyond too big to fail. So to try again to be reactionary to too big to fail, they're still one step behind the eight ball, as they consistently have been over the decades. Dodd-Frank did some great things. It established the Consumer Protection Bureau. It provided for orderly liquidation, which is what Speaker Ryan's talking about in terms of the bailout. It established the Financial Services Oversight Commission, which we would argue is just one more piece of bureaucracy. But it also established the Volcker Rule, which eliminated or sharply curtailed proprietary trading for investment companies, for investment banks, and provided for stress tests. And it provided for some oversight of derivatives, which were a large piece of the crash in 2008. There's still a lot of jobs in the derivatives market that's not regulated. So if they really wanted to do something to prevent the next crash, they could have really addressed the derivatives aspect of it, which was a huge underpinning of the crash in the first place.
I want to talk about the CHOICE Act and what it does call for. Can you walk us through some of the core changes in the Republicans' CHOICE Act?
Sure. Sure. First of all, it pretty much guts the Consumer Protection Bureau, the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau. They want to change it to a, more of a law enforcement agency with a chairman who's appointed by the president rather than an independent agency. But then they want to gut the majority of it. So it would be almost like buying a house and paying the taxes on it and paying the utilities, but then not living there. So they're going to, it's just going to be expensive. It's going to be an expensive agency that has no teeth. It eliminates the orderly liquidation aspect of the Volcker Rule. So it would eliminate the option for bailouts. The Supreme Court may have taken care of some of that as well when they decided that bailing out American General, or AIG, was the was unconstitutional. So to the degree that that liquidation elimination has teeth would be questionable. But in any event, it eliminates the liquidation aspect of the Volcker Rule. It eliminates some of the stress tests, which is actually a great thing for the small and mid-sized banks. Opens up the markets for them to make riskier loans, which was some of the problem of the 2008 crash. It eliminates a lot of the oversight that was established in Dodd-Frank, specifically the Financial Services Oversight Commission. It eliminates that. And most importantly is it minimizes the rule about qualified mortgages, which again means that it allows banks to provide riskier mortgages.
And as I understand it, it also puts the budget of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau under the purview of Congress, which I guess could mean that the agency itself could be defunded. Is that a possibility?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
So what do you see as, when we look back at the Great Recession and as you were getting at some of the underpinnings behind it, what do you think going forward, we see in this Choice Act that will affect whether or not this could happen again?
We looked at the different types of, like I said, most of Congress's actions in terms of managing the financial markets has been reactionary. So when mutual funds were established, then they created a law to regulate mutual funds. Investors, investment advisors came along and they created a law to regulate investment advisors. We argue in the book that getting rid of Dodd-Frank is not such a bad thing, but we would get rid of a lot more than that. We wouldn't want a Wild West. We wouldn't want a market free-for-all. We would still want some basic regulation, but we're looking for a more holistic perspective when it comes to regulation and an elimination of the disclosure premise.
And what is that?
When the SEC was established in 1934 after the market crash and the laws that were passed in 33, the whole basis of our market regulation is disclosure. Companies, public companies, provide financial information, and that's what allows investors to make smart decisions. So the regulations that were passed in 33 and 34 were supposed to protect investors and eliminate or manage fraud and market manipulation and prevent that. And all of that was supposed to be done through companies disclosing what they're doing. We don't, and that was also based on the fact that you would buy the Disney Company because you loved Mickey Mouse and you thought the Disney Company was a great company and you really thought that you were buying the company. We don't trade like that anymore. The market doesn't function like that anymore and hasn't for a long time. The disclosure premise has come and gone. And the idea that companies disclose their financial condition every quarter and that creates more volatility in the markets based on whether or not they did what analysts thought they were going to do in 3 months' time, that just adds more volatility without adding any substance.
We're talking with Karen Coons right now. She's an associate professor of public administration at West Virginia State University, co-author of the book When the Levees Break, Reimagining Regulations in the Securities Market. And she's with us to talk about the Choice Act, what it does to roll back Dodd-Frank and what effect it could have on markets and the economy.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What do you think of this move to overhaul Dodd-Frank, change a lot of things there? Do you think that that law should be replaced or stay as it is? What role do you think Congress, the federal government, should have in regulating banks and other financial institutions? Do we need big changes? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll continue the conversation in just a bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris.
And I'm Veronica Rickard, and we're continuing our conversation about the new CHOICE Act, which would gut major portions of the 2010 Dodd-Frank Act, which was put into place following the Great Recession. Karen Coons is with us now. She's an associate professor of public administration at West Virginia University and co-author of the book When the Levees Break, Reimagining Regulations in the Securities Market.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you watching as the House voted yesterday to repeal or largely repeal the Dodd-Frank Act? What do you think Congress, what do you think the federal government should be doing with a bank and financial institution regulation? Are you worried that under the current standards or if they're changed, we might see another big crash, another great recession? What question do you have about regulations and how they work in the market? And do you worry about banks that are too big to fail or, as our guest says, too big to save if it should come to that? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Karen, you said that in your estimation, the government was making policy that was reacting to things that happened instead of looking to the future and having a smart eye to shaping policy about what might come to fruition. And you use the phrase too big to save. What did you mean by that?
We change, as I started to mention before, we change how we invest has changed dramatically. For starters, the retail investor does not make up a large portion of the market. And even then, what's done is primarily algorithmic trading. So it's all done with financial engineers and strings of economic models. And that's what determines whether to buy or sell. An example of that type of volatility was this afternoon, as there was talk about, as the CHOICE Act passed and there was talk about it going forward, the financial stocks rallied. It was they were the basis for the last hour's rally at the in the stock market. But there's no basis in a stronger valuation for these stocks, particularly given that the CHOICE Act is not going to get any traction in the Senate, or is not expected to get any traction in the Senate. And if they do pass something, it would still end up in reconciliation. So why people would be buying bank stocks, why there'd be this big clamor for bank stocks to produce that kind of a rally without a fundamental valuation or increase in valuation for the companies really shows how the market's changed. And again, it's not the retail investor that's driving this. It's institutional and algorithmic trading that's driving it. So the market's changed quite a bit.
So the market is not what it used to be, but can we explore a little more your question about what that means? In the past, during the Great Recession, the government bailed out the banks because they were said to be too big to fail, and that would devastate the American economy. So what does it mean if a bank is too big to save?
When a stock market can be brought down by a tweet that says there's a bomb in the White House, we know that we need to be more tech-savvy. We need to understand that the whole system could be hacked and trashed in a matter of minutes. Yet the regulators aren't funded. I mean, when you talked about the CFPB being unfunded by Congress or not included in the budget, the same thing has held true for the SEC and for the other regulators. They're not getting the funds they need to be able to catch up or to be able to stay consistent or even anticipate problems or technological advances. So there are a number of things now that could bring down the market system that the regulators aren't even able to anticipate because they're not funded, they're not able to keep up. Again, everything is still reactionary.
Let's take a caller now. We've got Maureen joining us in Waukesha. Maureen, hi.
Hi. I want to thank your guest. She's excellent at explaining complex concepts. But I have two questions. Sure. My first question is, you know, as an expert in your field, what would your recommendation be for regulation to help us avoid failing? And the other question is, you know, what your thoughts are on how politicized regulation is. Are we regulating based on what a voter base is going to vote on versus what's really good for our country?
Maureen, thanks for that. And Karen?
We really outlined what we would like to see in the book. And in a nutshell, it's based on a couple of premises. One is that whole disclosure idea of companies having to keep disclosing and adding to volatility. We say, let's get rid of that. And investors don't use that anyway. They don't make decisions based on that. The whole idea, the whole premise is outmoded. What we'd like to do is that we have a more holistic approach. Let's make companies really disclose everything there is to know about them at the start and then never have to worry about it again unless there's a major change. So they can keep issuing stocks and bonds as long as they're stable. But they'd have to be stable first, so companies like Tesla and Twitter, who weren't profitable to begin with, wouldn't have a chance until they were. So investors couldn't buy companies that never showed a profit. There would still be the side for private investment, for startups and things like that. But for the main part, we would change that. The other thing we would eliminate is the gambling concept. When you buy a stock, like, for example, when you buy Disney, you can go to Disney Company. You can open the door. You can knock on the door. You can go see the president. You can sit in the chair across from his desk. It's a tangible. There's a company there. When you buy derivatives, if you dig deep, 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 deep down, you might find a scrap of a piece of a mortgage. If you put them all together, you still wouldn't come up with one solid asset to go back to. They're gambling. It's nothing better than gambling. Futures, the same thing. When you buy orange juice futures, you're betting on whether or not the sun's going to shine. So what we say is, let's take those things that are considered investments now that aren't, they don't go through any kind of approval before they come to market. So investors don't get, they're not savvy enough in the most part to deal with them anyway. But let's take those and call them what they really are, which is gambling, and put them under a gaming commission. Send them to Vegas. But they don't belong in the stock market.
Maureen, thank you for that call. And I want to get at an aspect that we haven't explored yet in Maureen's question. Financial regulation used to be a bipartisan enterprise, and now it seems to be more of a highly partisan process, perhaps on both sides, although maybe now more than during the Great Recession. But how has that changed things?
I think it's difficult to get things done. I think both sides are still reactionary. Consumer protection is really important. It's something that's kind of fallen by the wayside as we've evolved from the regulations that started the whole thing in 33 and 34. So investor protection has kind of slid away. The Consumer Finance Protection Bureau was an attempt to put investors back in the forefront. So I think that's still important. But how to do that, whether it should be a regulatory aspect, how we would regulate markets to put investors first, is a discussion that I don't think either side is really having.
And is it because, as Maureen suggested, politicians are too concerned about their voting base?
I think that's a large part of it. And they seem to think that eliminating regulation is the answer. But again, the Wild West of a market is not an answer. Intelligent, structured, holistic regulation is. But right now, there are a couple of dozen regulators between 8 federal agencies and self-regulatory organizations, not to mention the 50 states who all have their hands in regulation. How any brokerage firm can stay on top of that is beyond me.
Well, Maureen, thanks a lot for your call. And we're going to go next to Charlie in Milwaukee. Charlie, hi.
Hi, thank you so much. My question is that historically, when the pay of the top CEO was a was closer to the lowest worker, that there was not as much a large difference. Both the company and the United States and the workers did better. Isn't there a way to have that type of regulation where the company still exists for the betterment of the United States as well as its workers, as well as giving its top managers a great living? Isn't that the goal rather than just the pure greed that we're seeing with our current system?
Charlie, thank you for that call. And also, Karen, I believe there's a change in the House GOP Choice Act that would take away the requirement to disclose CEO pay. But to Charlie's other point, what would you say to that?
That's a tough one. We tend to think that companies, that we don't tell companies what to do. Whether you're Apple or the local hardware store down the street, we don't tell you how to run your company. We don't tell you how to pay your employees, other than minimum wage, the basic things, safety, stuff like that. So it's questionable whether more regulation would change that, would make that better for the markets. Would it increase the valuation of the company for investors? If you were in our paradigm, what we also talk about is shifting the idea of buying stocks to something similar to buying a car or a toaster, where you would have lemon laws that would protect you. If the company went belly up or did some really squirrely things, you could have recourse to getting your money back. Have labeling laws like you see on packages, food packages when you go to the grocery store. There's so much sugar, there's so much content, carbohydrates, there's so much protein. Well, in this case, the CEO gets this pay. The risk tolerance for people who want to buy this stock is here. So if this is really conservative or this is really a riskier type of investment, the company has 50,000 employees and 90% of them make under $20 an hour, but different types of labeling and other things, warrants, warranties or incentives for companies that want you to buy their products and to continue to buy their products. So we look at that idea as more viable than the system that we have now.
And we leave it there. Karen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me. It was my pleasure.
It was Karen Kunz, an associate professor of public administration at West Virginia University and the co-author of the book, When the Levees Break, Reimagining Regulations in the Securities Market. She joined us to talk about the House Republicans' decision to overhaul large portions of the Dodd-Frank Act.